No one disputes that addiction can devastate lives, leave families in financial ruin, and rip communities apart. But what is the right approach to prevent addiction? How successful are treatment options when someone does become addicted? And what's happening in the brain of an addict that makes recovery so difficult? These are the questions tackled in a new report called Facing Addiction in America, the Surgeon General's Report on Alcohol, Drugs, and Health. We're discussing new ways of thinking about addiction today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. In 2015, 27 million people in the United States reported using illicit drugs or misused prescription drugs. Another 66 million reported binge drinking in the previous month. The financial impact combined is more than $400 billion in accidents, health-related expenses, lost job time. These daunting numbers are part of the U.S. Surgeon General's new report on addiction. What does it mean for our state and our nation to have a big percentage of the population under the influence? Here to discuss the report and the way forward is Dr. Jay Butler, the state's top doctor.
Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Dr. Butler. Dr. Butler is Alaska's chief medical officer and is the director of the Public Health Division. And on the line from Juneau is Kara Nelson from Haven House. Hi, Kara.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks both of you for being here. You in the listening audience can also join our conversation. If you have a question for Dr. Butler or an observation about substance abuse in your community, give us a call. The numbers statewide are 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Butler, why is this report significant? What does it tell us that's different from what we already know?
Well, the Surgeon General's report really redefines substance use disorders and the most severe form of substance use disorder, addiction, as a chronic health condition primarily involving the brain. This is a game changer because in many ways we've thought of addiction as primarily a criminal justice issue. We've thought of it as an issue that is primarily just bad decisions or moral failings. And it helps reframe that discussion about how we begin to make changes. As a physician, as I read through the report and as I've been involved in some of the discussions that have led up to it, it's begun to make a lot of sense because I understand much better now how a patient can sit across from me, look me right in the eye, and say, "Doc, I am never going to do that again." Mm. Yet the next night, they're in the emergency department because they've done it again. And it helps us understand the neurobiology behind addiction and why at that moment in time, that was my patient's true intent, was to never do that again. But because the changes that occur in the brain, those behaviors begin to manifest. And until we begin to address addiction in that way, we're not going to be able to make a difference.
Well, I want to talk about what that new understanding or that realization is about it being a chronic health condition. But first, let's talk about some of the numbers. We often hear about an opioid overdose epidemic in the country. That's a phrase that is out there quite a bit. What are the facts? Are the numbers still climbing? Do we have a sense of where addiction is? And part of the reason that I ask is that the the most recent report on high school students shows that smoking and drug use is on the decline, which is fantastic, of course.
That's correct.
So how do these things square? What's the reality that we're at today with where abuse is and where you're seeing the numbers? Are we still increasing? Is it tapering off? What's happening?
Well, it's important to start by recognizing that the opioid epidemic is just one aspect of the challenges we have with substance use disorders in our country. That for decades we've had issues with alcohol. We have issues with other illicit substances and certainly misuse of prescription drugs other than opioid pain relievers. In some ways, the opioid crisis has put the issue of addiction on the front page as well as on the radar screen of public health, not just it being an issue that's kind of dealt with in the clinics. Most people really don't like dealing with it. But now it's provided an opportunity for us to all focus on the issue, in part because almost everyone has been touched in some way by the opioid epidemic. I'm going to quote my esteemed daughter, who I think made an excellent observation that when she was growing up in Anchorage, she didn't even hear about self-injection drug use until she was in her late teens, whereas her six-year-old son personally knows someone who has died of a heroin overdose. So, you know, I just use that as an example that is far too common, that everyone has been touched in some way by this challenge. The opioid epidemic really started about 20 years ago, particularly once sustained-release OxyContin was approved. And it was in a series of perfect storms in that the way we manage pain in medicine began to change quite a bit. I think there was quite a bit of misinformation about the risk of addiction. And even in terms of what the goals were of how to manage chronic pain. And it's important to recognize that pain can be debilitating and we need to manage it well. But also for chronic pain syndrome, it ignored the fact that tolerance develops with opioids and that increasing doses are needed for the same effect. So, and there's a few exceptions to that. Some people seem to do very well on chronic opioids, but most people do not. And even though we had a fourfold increase in the prescription rate of opioids, there's no evidence that there was declines in pain in our country. In fact, if anything, that the pain levels reported at the population level continued to increase. As we get into around 2010-2011, we've seen basically a fourfold increase in prescriptions of opioids. We've seen a fourfold increase in the rates of overdose deaths. And that was a time then when a new heroin market began to open up, with heroin coming primarily out of Mexico rather than South America and Southeast Asia. Very high quality and also being marketed very differently. The historic heroin markets have been primarily in the inner cities, primarily in the East, but now heroin was being sold in the West, in the suburbs, and really everywhere. And there was quite a opioid hunger. And I'm using a term actually from the 18th century that was commonly used before opioids were even injected, because people generally took opium by mouth or smoked it, but it was oftentimes called the opioid hunger. The influx of heroin then led to higher rates of heroin use, more overdoses due to that. And then the third perfect storm has been the influx of the synthetic opioids, which include illicit fentanyl and many chemicals that don't even have names beyond things like W18 or U4770, because they were still developmental in the pharmaceutical industry, but they can now be purchased over the internet and oftentimes are delivered by mail to dealers that then sell it. And oftentimes it may be presented as heroin, but it's actually a synthetic opioid.
The you were talking about the rise, the fourfold increase in prescriptions of opioids. Why has that happened? If we're not seeing an explosion in more pain-related illnesses or, you know, something that corresponds with this rapid increase. Why are so many prescriptions being written for these drugs, or why were they? Maybe that's changing now.
Well, that's certainly a complex question, but just some observations that I will offer. They were very heavily marketed, and some of the marketing was misleading. In fact, that led to a very large fine against one of the pharmaceutical manufacturers, the maker of OxyContin, that was nearly two-thirds of $1 billion based on the fact that the data that was presented on the risk of addiction was really not appropriate for how it was being used. Mm-hmm. And I've actually seen a screenshot of one of the direct-to-consumer marketing tools that was produced by the pharmaceutical company saying the risk of addiction is less than 1%. And it is cited to a study, quote unquote, but that study was a 101 word to the letter of the letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, which was a review of patients who were hospitalized and had no history of substance use disorder and were ultimately discharged after an acute problem and did not follow in terms of use of opioids or starting opioids after discharge. These data were then being applied to everyone walking into the general practitioner's office with low back pain and to support the claims that these drugs were totally safe, there was no risk of addiction. And I think that really flies in the face of what we saw. At the same time, there was also a big push to eliminate pain. And the pain scores, I think, helped make people more aware of management of pain, but at the same time, they were very misleading. The phrase was, pain is the fifth vital sign. Well, fact is, pain is a subjective experience, and it's influenced by many things, more than just the pathology or the damage to the body, but also by fear, anxiety, your past experiences. And so it really is a syndrome. It's not like a temperature or a pulse or a respiration or a blood pressure. These are vital signs that are objective measures of the health of the body. Pain is an experience, and it can be very hard to put a number onto that. And, you know, reducing that numeric equivalent lower, I think, was very misguided.
Well, I'd love to have a conversation about the change that happened in society once pharmaceutical companies started directly marketing, advertising to consumers, but that's a whole other show.
That's
a different conversation, and we don't want to get distracted. I want to get Kara in. Kara Nelson with Haven House. Hello. Tell us, please, Kara, about Haven House in Juneau.
Hi. Well, thanks again for having me on your show. And Haven House is a faith-based, peer-led recovery residence for women who are coming home after incarceration. And we really utilize the peer support model, as well as modeled after, which was actually mentioned in the Surgeon General's report, the National Association of Recovery Residences. So we're modeled after a level two recovery residence.
So can you talk a little bit, Kara, about the women that you work with? What are their biggest struggles substance-wise when they come to you and need this community support? What are they mostly struggling with?
Recently, we've seen more opioid and meth addictions. Of course, as we know, these have been a long line of, you know, economic factors, in and out of prison because of substance use disorder, untreated mental health issues, and really the core of the issue, which is the trauma, and really getting down to the bottom of things while living in a peer environment and being able to be vulnerable and work through things where normally it's been a very punitive space for them. Mm. So we're really working towards exactly what we're talking about here.
And Kara, what's your own journey been in this? Why are you involved and the director of Haven House?
Well, I am a person in long-term recovery from substance use disorder. And for me, that means that I haven't used a drink or a drug since June 1st, 2011. That is also the day that I was, thank you. That's also the day that I stepped out for the last time from Lemon Creek Correctional Center. And so I have 20 plus years of field work out there with substance use disorders, as well as, really understanding the challenges with incarceration and being a mother and family and community member. So, I'm very well experienced in all areas. And then just walking through this journey of this shift through our society and really elevating the voices of those who are directly impacted.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing the Surgeon General's new report. It's called Facing Addiction in America, the Surgeon General's Report on Alcohol, Drugs, and Health. And in the studio with me is Dr. Jay Butler, Alaska's top medical officer. And in the studio in Juneau at KTOO is Kara Nelson, the director of Haven House. Kara, I have one more question for you, and then I've got a whole bunch of them for Dr. Butler. And I want to remind folks that you can join our conversation, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. And in Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. There has been a lot of attention focused on substance abuse. The Surgeon General came to Alaska to highlight the problem as part of a national outreach. Kara, are you seeing an impact from these kinds of efforts? Are community attitudes toward people with addictions changing? Or what are you seeing on the ground? You're right there working.
Yeah. Is that a trick question?
No.
I had the opportunity actually October 4th, 2015 to watch the Surgeon General come out in front of tens of thousands of us who were rallying for recovery in Washington, D.C. on the Mall, National Mall, who told us that he was going to do this. And he made that promise to us. And to be able to watch it come forth in the way that it has, when he came up to Anchorage, actually on August 3rd, which happens to be my birthday, so it was a great birthday present. I was able to spend some time with him and really, have this platform in front of medical professionals and then our general public here in Alaska with all of the leadership that we have in our health providers and professionals and recovery supports. And, I definitely have seen a shift. I've been on many of the coalitions, the Alaska Opioid Task Force, and then our local coalitions, and I'm thoroughly involved with justice reform. And it all goes together. And there are some incredible people in leadership at the moment really taking action. But, one of the biggest shifts I've seen as someone who's formerly incarcerated, putting people like myself and others in leadership positions, because when we're directly impacted, we can work together in all sectors to really fill in the gaps that we've lived it. And so our families have lived it, and policies are being made that are directly impacting us. And that just really is a huge piece of really healing our communities. And I am seeing that. It is difficult because I am working on the ground level and it's not happening fast enough. Mm. It's difficult when people don't understand the continuum of care with recovery, because treatment is not, you don't graduate and then you're better. There's so many pieces to it. Treatment works, it's just one piece. And then we all have to work together. And one of the greatest things I've seen in our state, and Dr. Butler has been a part of this as well, is just the incredible collaborations from all sectors and all organizations and nonprofits and people on the ground. Now, of course, we need to do much better at that, but I've never seen just the collaboration that is happening and people really opening their minds to understand. And maybe you don't know, but Haven House really fought to be where we're at. And we did face some challenges, to be there and to really change the hearts and minds of our community, even here in the state capital. And really, it could have been a really difficult challenge, but we really took it as a platform to show that, stigma and shame is what is killing our people. Mm-hmm. Stigma and shame, and then showing what long-term recovery looks like, and that it is possible and it can happen. We do recover.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for those inspiring words. And I want to remind our listeners that this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about the Surgeon General's report on addiction in America. We've got Dr. Jay Butler in the studio in Anchorage and Karen Nelson of Haven House in the studio in Juneau. We're going to go to the phones for a moment. SJ is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I, like a number of people who've been working in the field of addiction and substance abuse, those who have been involved from the criminal justice system through service providers, I've known for a long time that addiction is an illness. And it's great to see this recognition from the federal government. But I guess my question is, how does that change anything? What can we do differently? I mean, right now, the Department of Corrections is the largest provider of mental health services in the state, and that includes, for instance, and that includes substance abuse issues. And it seems like, what kind of program do you start to catch people before they fall through the cracks? Because right now, what happens is, I mean, just because you have an illness, if you're not treating it, that illness is going to run its course on you, and that's why people end up in the criminal justice system, because they steal, or they're abusing others, or other things that come with the addiction. And so the question is kind of, what's the next step if we have this recognition from the federal government that addiction is an illness?
Well, thank you for the call and the question, SJ. I think the numbers say something upwards of 80% of people who go into the criminal justice system have some either substance abuse or mental health issue that they're struggling with.
That's correct.
80%.
Right. And of course, not all are incarcerated for drug charges. But it highlights the fact that addiction sometimes drive property crimes and even violent crime to support the addiction. One of the things that I think is really beautiful in the Surgeon General's report is right after the introductory chapter, it lays the foundation for the discussion that follows on what to do based on the neurobiology of addiction, and goes through the parts of the brain that are affected, as well as a behavioral model of how substance use can lead to misuse, which can ultimately lead to addiction. And it begins to explain how, from a neuroanatomic approach, how parts of the brain, such as the basal ganglia, reinforce triggers that can cause people to reuse, whether it's seeing certain people, being in certain places, certain sights or smells, highlighting the need for a change of environment. The amygdala is involved, which influences our ability to be able to enjoy life, and that the things that oftentimes give us simple pleasures, like food or the company of another person, begin to be suppressed by the desire for the addictive substance. And then the prefrontal cortex, which is sometimes called the executive center, which sounds like somebody in a suit behind a desk, but actually it's talking about our ability to make decisions and to regulate our actions and to prioritize what's important. Is that baby crying the most important thing to me, or is another hit the most important thing to me? So building on that, we can then begin to talk about, and I hate to say talk because we really need action, but first we have to all get on the same page
and
in
understand.
Terms of what we're dealing with, exactly. That can oftentimes be a driver of behaviors that put people into the criminal justice system, which creates an opportunity to intervene if we are willing to recognize how we might be able to intervene. Because particularly when people have been in prison and they're discharged, they haven't had the medical care they need in terms of their addiction being addressed as a chronic condition that they will still have as they go out. They have no job skills. They may not even have a home to go to. We shouldn't be so amazed that they wind up back in the criminal justice
system.
Almost
half of them, yes.
And another part of this neurobiologic basis is recognizing that some of these changes that occur in the brain last for a long time, and that, quick intervention, sometimes called detox. I think probably a better term is withdrawal management, because detox implies that there's something in the body, and if you just get it out, then you're healed. Fact is, oftentimes the brain is working differently, and it's going to work different for quite some time. And for some people, it may be lifelong. So the report gets into factors not only in terms of prevention and treatment, but also how to live in recovery. As Kara has highlighted, things like peer recovery coaches and recovery housing are really critical to making that difference in the long term. I heard a prosecutor who I thought is really beginning to understand this and said it really well. He said, I've spent 20 years locking people up because they piss me off. They just seem to make the same stupid mistakes again and again. Now I understand they didn't have a choice. Maybe early in life there were some bad choices, but ultimately the choices were lost because the brain has been hijacked by the addictive substances and how it influences basic brain function.
So they're not just bozos doing bozo things. They have addictions and they just can't see their way clear to make good decisions.
That is a major challenge.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. John is in Sitka. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Did you have a question?
Yes. A statement as well. I've been sober 27 years. And because of that, you know, I've had support at the very beginnings with people in the communities that I was in Seward, and it really helped when somebody was there to be there with me when I was going through all of the withdrawals and all of those things. And I became a spiritual counselor in Sitka at a treatment center here. And when I was working in the program, I started seeing something that was weak in the treatment programs, and it could be everywhere. Is when they go home to the same place they were using, and were the same problems were there, the same things were going on, family dysfunction, all of those things. And I suggested to the higher ups, because I was just a counselor or just a spiritual counselor, and I suggested that maybe we should start going home with them and spending a month or 2 months with them while they try to strengthen and getting their feet under them, because they seem to just go back into the same thing, fight as hard as they can, but it just repetitive, seeing their families in it, using it. And I suggest, you know, to the long term, we should start going to their communities with them, spending time with them until they get stronger, and seeing what is going on in the communities. Because once we let them out the door, that's the last we see of them until they come back through again.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I see that if we, you know, if this new statement has come out, maybe we need to strengthen the home when they leave the treatment center and go home. Maybe we need to send somebody with them for a while to make sure that they are participating in community activities. I'm a community activist, still am, and maybe we can promote and help them in that area.
Sure.
So
some healthy,
I think, we
activities
need to do something at the tail end of all of their treatment,
right,
and go with them and
absolutely
see what's going on.
Thank you so much, John, for the call. Kara, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, this report really addresses that, because like I was talking about earlier, you know, treatment was one piece of it. And this long-term recovery continuum of care, it really takes, I love what you just said about surrounding and healing the families, because that's really where it's at. And that's where I have the privilege to work with Haven House ladies, where sometimes up to a year, 2 years, I know in the report it says even after a year, then your brain can start to be in remission. It takes time to walk through life things. And one of the things that it talks about in the report is recovery community organizations and recovery coaches, as Dr. Butler mentioned earlier. And these are very crucial, which is exactly what you were talking about, the the gentleman on the call, you know, really having that peer support and guiding people. And I just want to, you know, really highlight this is why this report is so incredible, because it is the long-term lifetime continuum of care from prevention, you know, to long-term lifelong recovery. And one of those things is about really developing an entity of recovery community support services within the communities, which we've been really lacking. And I'm really proud in Juneau that we've, and in Anchorage, I know, they have different supports now that we didn't have a few years back. And so that goes also back to the incarceration piece, that we know that 80% of people incarcerated have mental health and substance use disorders. And so we are working aggressively with Department of Corrections right now to be able to bring peers in so that we can meet them at the gate and follow them through and plug them into these resources. And we have to remember that these are being built as we're doing it. And so they haven't been there prior, but they're there now. And everything in this report, it goes in direct alignment of wellness that we know with agencies, organizations, and with peers and families. And so I just would like to really go back to the report and show that it everything in there is all about long-term recovery in this continuum of care after, you know, getting out of treatment, after having those interventions, and then continue. It could take, you know, it's not for us to say how many times it's going to take.
And I wanted to mention before we take a quick break here, we do have a link to that report on our website, alaskapublic.org, so you can go there and follow it to the Surgeon General's report and read it for yourself. We'll be back in just a moment as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein. Online at lbblawyers.com. And by
GCI. Keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the Surgeon General's report called Facing Addiction in America, the Surgeon General's report on alcohol, drugs, and health. It's a big, massive report, more than 400 pages, Dr. Butler.
428, but who's counting?
So if you are going to go read it, wait till after the program so you can stay with us for the next half an hour. You know, the conversation before we went to the break was about how you sort of have to wrap around the individual in a very comprehensive way, supporting them for the long term, not just, okay, you're done with treatment now, go forth and be good. AA for decades has had the message about you have to change your behavior. You can't, you know, you were talking about triggers, going right to old places and the old gang and smells and sights and things that can set people off. So those long-time kind of tested methods of helping people stay in recovery are within this idea and have been built upon. The title of the report lists alcohol first.
Right.
So let's have some context about where the biggest concerns are. Is alcohol still a bigger problem overall than other drugs, or have opioids overtaken that, or how would you gauge that, Dr. Butler?
Well, the short answer, I think, is yes and, as they train stand-up comics to respond to hecklers. Alcohol kills more Alaskans than opioids do. So let's start with that. And alcohol has been a long-standing problem in Alaska that has been ignored for far too long. There are also, though, some unique aspects about the opioid epidemic that we need to address. We've seen a fourfold increase in the overdose death rate. We still see 3 to 4-fold more alcohol-related deaths than we do opioid deaths, but that number is fairly stable, not doubling every few years the way we've seen with opioids. Another issue with opioids is we may have more opportunities to intervene in terms of reducing the risk of overdose, or actually reversing the end stage of a near-fatal overdose through use of the drug Narcan or naloxone that reverses the depression of the respiratory center that makes people stop breathing when they overdose. We also have a challenge with opioids when it involves self-injection, and particularly using or sharing of needles, mm-hmm. transmission of the AIDS virus, HIV, and hepatitis C. So they're kind of two different things, and we need to address both of them. Mm-hmm. So I don't see it as an either or.
Well, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Jeff is in Barrow. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
Good morning. Did you have a question?
Well, just a brief comment. Thank you for taking my call. I want to introduce listeners to a fascinating book called Nutrient Power by William Walsh, PhD. You can see it at walshinstitute.org. This book presents an advanced nutrient therapy system that can help millions of persons with mental disorders. This approach recognizes that most humans have nutrient imbalances due to genetic and environmental factors, and these imbalances can cause mischief in various ways. The Mensa Medical Center practices largely based on this approach and has an 85% cure rate for mental disorders such as depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, ADHD, and other problems without the use of pharmaceutical medications. And so mensamedical.com is where you can see more information, listen to some great videos. And so for your listeners who are seeking non-pharmaceutical effective ways to overcome depression, anxiety, and other mental challenges, this is a great read, and recommend them to look into
All
the
right.
availability of,
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks for the call, Jeff. I'm glad that we have Dr. Butler in the studio. Non-pharmaceutical relief for treatment of depression and other things, Dr. Butler. What's the science tell us?
Well, the Surgeon General's report talks about both pharmaceutical management as well as behavioral therapy. And one of the take homes from it is that there are many paths to mm-hmm. recovery. I oftentimes use the term addictions rather than addiction because I think in many ways we're going to find in the coming decades that kind of like cancer 100, 150, 200 years ago, we generally thought of it as one disease. Now we know that cancers represent over 300 different types of diseases. We may find that there are a lot of different things that influence whether or not addiction is manifest.
Mm-hmm. Kara, did you want to comment at all about other methods of helping people either address mental health concerns or addictions?
Well, I think one of the highlights that we see is really exercise and really getting those endorphins going. And that's something we really push, you know, as often and as much as possible, and getting buddies together to really be active. I'm in recovery from mental health disorder, and I currently take no medications, but I did for a long time, and I'm not against medication. There are many pathways to recovery and many pathways to wellness. And, you know, for me, I have to exercise. I personally play roller derby, which is a great sport to just get the body going, you know, and it's just very important. All pathways to recovery is also something that is really highlighted in the report with substance use and mental health disorders, because you mentioned AA, which is a mutual aid group, and there are several you know, in our community, but we're really trying to create all aspects and all pathways, spiritual, sobriety, you know, celebrate recovery. I mean, there's a ton of them out there. We need to have every option for every single Alaskan.
Let's talk about the report itself, Dr. Butler. As you've said, it's massive, 428 pages. Past Surgeon Generals have also released some sort of landmark type studies in the 60s, a study on tobacco use that came out in the 80s, HIV/AIDS, a big report from the Surgeon General, and in 1999, a study on mental health. What kind of societal and policy impacts can these types of reports have? What have we observed from the past reports that have maybe changed thinking and also changed how we approach these things legally?
Well, I think the biggest parallel is probably with 1964 report from Surgeon General Luther Terry on tobacco and health. That one was 387 pages. It was a leather-bound report. Fortunately, even though the 2016 report on alcohol, drugs, and health is a little larger than that, it's available for free to everyone in PDF format, so it can be downloaded. I did not lug one in here, but I have it on my iPad here if I need to refer to it. It's interesting to talk about how that report has changed society. The 10 members of the technical writing committee that reviewed the data and developed that report, five of them actually smoked. And so if you see any pictures of the team as they met and worked, you'll see ashtrays full of cigarette butts in the middle of the table. As I recall, of the five who smoked, there were two who were not able to quit. And there were members of that team that ultimately died of lung cancer as well. There was a lot of pushback that oftentimes we don't remember now, but in the 60s, in terms of disregarding it as not good science, there were concerns about putting labels on things and restricting the industry. In fact, the 1964 Surgeon General's report was released on a Saturday morning, intentionally giving time for the report to sink in and for the markets to potentially adapt to it so that there wouldn't be a sudden stock market decline after the report came out, because
wow.
At the time, more than 40% of adults smoked cigarettes. So it was anticipated that it would have a large economic impact. The following day, the Surgeon General's report was the lead story on most broadcast news on TV and radio, front page news in most papers around the country. I think we see some parallels of what happened last Thursday in terms of how much of a ripple effect that it's having, at least initially, in that this was the lead story on all the network news. In fact, someone observed it was the first time since the election that the transition was not the lead story. And it was picked up fairly broadly through print media and broadcast media as well. I know NPR featured it prominently. But when we look at the 64 report, look how much has changed. Now the smoking rates are more than one-third lower than they used to be, and our whole perception of cigarette smoking has changed. If this were 1963, we would probably be sitting here with an ashtray
between us.
And we would probably both be smoking. Certainly people in broadcasting thought that it gave them that Edward R. Murrow sound quality.
That husky FM voice.
That's right. And even in the 50s, there were physicians who recommended a cigarette because it was good for digestion. So
wow.
After dinner, have your cigarettes. And of course, there was marketing involved. There were samples of cigarettes that were distributed at AMA convention, American Medical Association conventions in the late 40s and in the 50s. The Surgeon General's report began a change that we continue to see impacting health in America and improving health. As a report from the CDC showed last week, death rates due to lung cancer have continued to decline and have declined for a couple of decades now, and I think that's directly attributable to the declines in cigarette smoking. So I guess one thing I'll say about the 2016 report is it could be a landmark and have long-ranging effects. The other is that it's not magic, and mm-hmm. there's certainly going to be pushback as well. There even will be people that maybe they'll call in even and disagree with the whole concept of addiction as a chronic health condition involving the brain. But things do change over time. It can be frustrating, though, how long it can take.
Well, and I do want to talk about that, but we're going to go to the phones just for a moment. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the Surgeon General's new report that just came out last Thursday called Facing Addiction in America. A link to it is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Let's go to Tina in Southeast Alaska. Hi, Tina.
Hi.
Do you have a question?
I do have a question. I have some concerns, and I'm not a very young adult. I'm not a senior citizen. I have chronic pain from arthritis that's widespread, and I've reached a point where I believe that I've been neglected because of other people's addictions to these pain medicines at all, that I have documented reason to obtain these things. And they're physicians who are scared to provide us relief. I'm wondering what protections there can be provided to physicians to actually administer relief to those of us who have chronic existences, you know?
Right, yes. I'm not saying
where it's hospice conditions. This is for us to be living.
Absolutely.
You know, I have both a teenager and I have a preschooler.
You know, Tina,
and
you've brought
I deal
up
with
go ahead.
My chronic pain every day. You know,
you have brought up a really good and important point, and I'm sorry that it's a struggle for you. I have a good friend that's in a very similar situation, has very severe arthritis, and is facing some of the same thing, has had pushback from doctors about, you know, how are you using these pain medications? This is somebody who has had to have surgeries and has a very, very deep need and a very legitimate need for pain relief. Dr. Butler, what is happening in that regard? As you mentioned, the report might have some pushback or some fallout that's unintended. What's happening with the concern level for doctors that are prescribing these drugs?
Well, I hear concern certainly from providers about whether or not they're going to be getting pressure from the DEA or other enforcement agencies. But I think Tina highlights a really challenging situation in that the treatment options for chronic pain are somewhat limited, and that particularly if opioids are the base, for many people, it requires escalating doses to be able to get the relief that they need. One of the biggest challenges is what do we reimburse for? What do we pay for treatment? And that's where, you know, as Carol was saying earlier, it takes a lot of different sectors to be able to work together to address this. And we need to engage with the insurance industry as well. It's a lot cheaper just to reimburse for a bottle of pills than to do some of the other measures that oftentimes are required to be able to manage chronic pain syndromes.
Mm-hmm. We are going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about addiction and recovery on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are talking about the new Surgeon General's new report on addiction in America. Dr. Jay Butler is in the Anchorage studio with us, and Kara Nelson of Haven House is in KTOO studio in Juneau. Dr. Butler, in our last 10 minutes here, and Kara, certainly you can jump in as well, I want you to help us understand what's known now about how addiction is viewed as a chronic condition, as a disease rather than a moral failing. What's going on in someone's brain when this is happening, a substance use disorder?
Well, the brain functions differently after repeated exposures to a substance, and it leads to a cycle that is actually outlined in the report about starting with binge and use and intoxication that can then lead to withdrawal and negative effects, ultimately then to preoccupation or anticipation of the next dose. And that cycle can become self-reinforcing and very difficult to interrupt. The section on the neurobiology is worth spending some time with, and it really is written not just for a medical audience. I realize it's fairly dense science, but it is well worth spending some time on that. It then begins lays the basis for the discussion of prevention. And in prevention, we're not just talking about preventing bad outcomes, such as reversing overdose effects or trying to reduce the rates of bloodborne pathogens, but also getting into what are some of the drivers that create the need to self-medicate, mm-hmm. and some of the community-based programs that address adverse childhood experiences or other personal trauma. We've mentioned underlying mental illness that may be undiagnosed or untreated, but also some organic brain conditions, such as traumatic brain injury, can increase the risk of becoming dependent on addictive substances. Post-traumatic stress disorder can be another driver. So being able to address some of those primary underlying needs are critical to be able to do the primary prevention as well. The report does get into treatment, though. So, I mean, as you've already gone through the statistics of how many people already are living with addiction, and it's oftentimes said that only 1 in 5 to 1 in 10 are even receiving treatment. We would not find that acceptable for diabetes or asthma or cancer, that so many people would go undiagnosed and not have access to treatment.
Well, it seems like a lot of that shift has to come with similar to what happened with the 64 report on tobacco. The shift has to come in society's thinking, going from a place of seeing addiction as a moral failing to a place of addiction as something that people really can't stop alone, that they have to have that help. Does it seem like that maybe would be one of the big potential impacts of this report is helping to shift that thinking so that we can shift policy to address these things?
Right. And it takes a broad-based policy. It's oftentimes been said we can't arrest our way out of this. Mm-hmm. Clinicians say we can't treat our way out of it. Fact is, we can't legislate our way out of it. We can't educate our way out of it. We can't eat our way out of it. I mean, there's all kinds of concepts of magic bullets of what we do. But there really is no magic bullet. It's going to be
a lot of hard work.
It's going to be effective buckshot that's going to require all of us working together. So it's not just changing policies and laws. A lot of the really hard work is going to occur at the community level mm-hmm. to be able to make a difference. And we have some very vibrant activities going on in our communities around Alaska, oftentimes led by people in recovery.
Like and I think Kara.
Such as Kara. Right. And I think that really highlights some of the reasons why there's reason for hope. But part of our job at the state level is to help facilitate that, remove barriers. And then at the national level, I think the report highlights some of the evidence base and provides some of the background information to help us guide which ways to go.
And I want to get a quick call in here. Sharon is in Homer, has a comment about treatment availability, which is, of course, a big issue. Hi, Sharon. Do you have a quick comment?
Hi, yes. And I actually have a second one now that I keep listening. But yes, I, as a nurse, mostly in the public health system, one of my greatest frustrations has been that we can get treatment for so many things, but when people are ready for treating addictions, I almost can never find a bed for somebody. And it does need to start with that initial care. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I want to say, referencing what Dr. Butler just mentioned, is that I think as a system, there's some great work happening on community levels with great collaboration about becoming trauma-informed, because we need to recognize the root causes. You know, somebody doesn't stick a needle up their arm because they're happy. You know, yeah. There's something going on. So I just think that's a really positive thing that's happening around our state. And anything that's sort of not a drug approach is probably a better way to go.
Mm. So taking
trauma-informed ourselves.
Right.
As a system, and yeah. addressing people where they are.
And taking out the judgment and shame aspect of it, because how does that help? It doesn't help. Kara, did you want to jump in here in the final moment?
Yeah, I just wanted to really say that, you know, we have this massive amount of people who aren't getting treatment, this massive amount of people who have experienced substance use disorder. And we also have over 24 million people in long-term recovery. And those are the people that haven't necessarily in the past stood up and stood out because of the shame and stigma. And our stories really bring a face and a voice to recovery. And so it does shift that perception within the community. It does shift and change hearts and minds, because this is a public health issue. And I, too, try and get people into I get calls daily, and we're not talking about Haven House women. I mean, just in our community, because they trust who I am. They know who I am. And so they call me to get their loved one into treatment. And sometimes, you know, it's just it's very frustrating. I believe our state is aggressively addressing that. I know they are, because I've watched it and I see it. We've got to do more, and we have to allow families to get help and not be ashamed to do that.
All right. Well, thank you so much to Kara Nelson of Haven House in Juneau. Thanks to KTOO. Thanks to Dr. Jay Butler, Alaska's Chief Medical Officer. And thank you for tuning in and listening today to Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.